got somebody clean and they're doing well for a year, for 2 years, and then you get the phone call that they found them dead in a ditch with a needle sticking in their arm. You see, that's ministry. Last weekend, I preached a funeral for a friend of mine who committed suicide. His two little kids go to our congregation, and I was there when they came in and they opened up the casket, and it was just the kids and the mother, and they walked in, and I watched the reaction of the kids as they saw their daddy laying there. That's ministry. I wish I could give you this happy ending, you know, with his story, but he wrestled with whether he even believed in God or not. He had come to church for a while, and then he stopped going, and then he said, I'm an atheist, and then at other times, I might believe. And it's just this back and forth, this seesaw. Sin is messy, life is messy, and so how do we minister to people who are sitting on the ash heap? I want to read this passage in Job. I think you all know the story pretty well, but there's an avenue that I think we sometimes miss. In Job chapter 1, I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Job chapter 1, starting in verse 13. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters, and I think at this point Job's heart sank because he knew. Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And I think at this point Job had to have been thinking, what are you doing to my life, God? And Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. I want to skip to chapter 2, starting in verse 7. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. I shared this part of the story yesterday. I'll share a little bit of it this morning. But in 2011, for those who don't know my story, I'm a full-time preacher at the Somerset Church of Christ. And July 29th, 2011, I got a phone call from a young lady, somebody I know and love and respect, and she said, can I come talk to you? she came up to my office that afternoon and handed me a piece of paper, and she was trembling. And I read what amounted to email correspondence between her and another female individual who were sexually abused by my father. It was the former minister where I preach. I went into ministry because of his example. In that moment, as I described yesterday, I said, I think this was the Spirit of God working, but I said the three words that I think she needed to hear in that moment: I believe you. And then I told her the next words that I think she needed to hear, and I think, again, that was Spirit-driven. And I said, I don't know what's going to happen to my job. I don't know what's going to happen to my family and where if we're going to have to move out of state. I didn't know any of that, but I said, it stops now. And on Monday, my mother and I were sitting inside of the police station reporting my father, and that decision forever changed our lives. We would find out very shortly after that that he had confessed to 23 victims, all prepubescent, very young children who he molested for years. 2012, 4 days before Father's Day, he was sentenced to 30-year mandatory minimum in state prison, 30 to 60 years. He'll be 92 years old when he's first eligible for parole. And it's where he belongs. And so don't feel bad and say, oh, your poor dad is in prison. He belongs there. He worked very hard to get that sentence. As I'm trying to wrap my mind around my childhood hero being wicked and evil, I was dealing with a whole bunch of other aftershocks from this earthquake that just rocked our life. Every Sunday I was getting up, and every Sunday I still get up, my 2 feet are literally planted in the same place where his 2 feet were planted for 27 years of his life. As I sat as a child looking up at my little hero being up on that stage, I stand there, and every Sunday I still wrestle with this idea. Now, how do you blend those two worlds, this incredible evil and this other part where he was a preacher and a confidant and a decent dad? And so I continued to preach, and I had to notify family members. Mom and I divvied up. Figured out, and I'm number 6 of 11 kids. I had to figure out, okay, which one of my siblings would be more receptive to me, Colin? Which one of the siblings would be more receptive to you, Colin, Mom? And just so many other circumstances. Well, when my dad talked to me, by the way, I got the phone call from him. He didn't know it was I who turned him in. So when he confessed to the police, I got the phone call. I've got to get something off my chest. I had to go and sit and listen to my father describe what he had done to these children. I continued to preach, and I had to minister to a church when I was in the middle of my ash heap. And a couple weeks later, I had to inform the congregation. I got the phone call from the detective, and she said, we just picked up your dad and took him to jail. It's going to be in the newspaper probably on Monday. This is the time to tell your congregation. So I had to write a statement and tell my congregation that the man who they loved and adored, and many of them were baptized by him, he did a lot of their weddings. I had to tell them that he was going to prison for sex crimes against children. Knowing that the parents with little children in our congregation had many deep and valid questions. And I just remember thinking, why, God? Why is all of this stuff happening? And my view of God, and you know, I'd been preaching for a couple years, my view of God was just shattered in an instant. I began getting phone calls very quickly from my dad's victims. When they found out I had turned him in, they now knew that for the first time in their life, there was somebody who would believe them when they told. They began to describe in very graphic details what my father had done to them when they were 2 years old, 3 years old, 5 years old. I forever carry those scars with me. I can't get rid of them. I can't unhear that, but I would never stop somebody and say, you can't talk to this. This is too heavy. You can't talk about this. I remember this was probably 4 weeks after I had turned my dad in. I just remember just the weight of all of this crashing in, and I don't know how to describe it any other way, but I just buckled under the weight of that heaviness of it all. I was having a hard time waking up. I was starting to battle depression and think, man, how do I keep ministering to a church? And I just felt like a fraud because I was just questioning God and saying, you know, it's not that I don't believe in you, God, but you better start talking. I remember finally the pivotal moment when I woke up and I went to my living room floor and I just literally fell down and I was in fetal position, sobbing like a little baby. That had never happened to me before. I ministered to people in all kinds of crazy situations, and I've never been the one who was the one who needed ministered to. And in that moment, as I'm down crying, I hear, we have a gravel driveway, and I hear tires crunching across the gravel, and I just thought, oh no, somebody's here, and they need something. And I was like, no. Or I'm waiting for the next person to give me the next bad news. And I look out, and it's one of our elders. So I went, I answered the door, and I'm sobbing, and I'm just crying. And he just looked at me, and he just knew what to say in that moment. And he hugged me, and he said, brother, I love you. He said, there are no words. He said, if you need anything, he said, if you and your wife and your daughter need to skip town for a month, 2 months, 5 months, he said, pack your suitcase right now, leave, and know that when you come back, you're going to have a family waiting with open arms. And I thought, now I'm starting to see God in a different light on top of that ash heap. There was somebody who entered into that ash heap. They climbed onto that ash heap with me. These events continued to keep happening, and just, you know, I eventually started the organization, Church Protect. We founded it 2 years ago. Because I was haunted by this notion that we lived with this man for my entire life, and nobody saw it. Nobody saw it, and that haunted me. That still haunts me. And so I wrote him from prison. I have hundreds of letters from him. I'm one of two family members who corresponds with him. And I continue to write letters and just find out, well, how did you do this? Why did you do it? What was going on? And trying to get into his mind and understand that level of wickedness. And I got to tell you, it's a very dark place, and a lot of times you just have to step away from it. The darkness is surreal. Things were going well, or so I thought, or maybe I was just numbed to all of it, but you get conditioned after a while. You get conditioned to pain, calloused. And so we were waiting for something positive to happen. Our middle child, when he was born in 2013, there was some crazy stuff going on at church that just kind of blew up. And it smoothed out after a while, but it was, and Natalie just looked at me and she said, can we not just have something happy happen? And God, leave that alone. And so 2 years ago, on May 13th, we had our third child, little boy Isaac. cute little guy. And May 22nd, 9 days later, I was laying down to go to bed and my phone rang. And it never rings in the evening. I always cringe when the phone rings in the evening because it's usually not something good. But I picked up the phone and it was one of my younger sisters. And she said, "Jimmy, what's going on?" I said, "Mandy, what are you talking about?" She said, "Mike is dead. Mike is our oldest brother." And when my son was 9 days old, the age of 42 years old, my brother, who's my build, my height, dropped dead of a massive heart attack. And that was on a Friday. On Sunday, I got up and preached. And right after that sermon, with an 11-day-old baby, my wife and my other two kids, we jumped in the car. We drove 12 hours down to Memphis. And the next day, I was preaching my brother's funeral. I remember going over to Mom's house that night, and she was just screaming out. I was the first one to get to the house. Mom was in her bed, and she was just sobbing, saying, "God, I hate you. How much more can this family take?" And she looked at me, and she said, "Jimmy, I'm so sorry. Once again, you're the one here. You're the one ministering to people." And she said, "Why does God keep doing this to you?" And I said, "Mom, here's the thing. If I didn't expect bad things to happen, if I didn't expect to be sitting with people when they're hurting and they're broken and they're suffering, even when I'm suffering too, if I didn't expect that to happen, I would have never gone into ministry." And I think we've got to stop telling people that as Christians, your life is going to be so free from any kind of burdens and life is going to be great, because it's not. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't find joy and happiness and peace and all those things, because we need those things. We desperately need those things when we're sitting on the ash heap. But to falsely tell people or to give them false hope and say, if you become a Christian, you're going to have this life free from pain, free from disasters, it's not going to happen. I just got a phone call, or a text message rather, from one of my very good friends, one of our church members. He packed up his wife, his newborn baby, and their 7-year-old daughter. And they drove down to Houston, Texas, to move in and stay with his boss as they care for their 2-year-old son, who they just found out has terminal cancer. He texted me on my way up here to New York. I came up Friday. On my way up here, I got a text message, and he said, "Little Mac just went to the hospital today, and they said the treatment didn't go well. They said he's in excruciating pain. And because of the chemo, they can't give him Tylenol for the pain. And he said all he does is screams in agony." 2-year-old. They put him on a morphine drip. 2. And so Travis and his wife Mariana are sitting on the ash heap with somebody. And it's exhausting. They left their home. They left their church family. They literally uprooted and went down to Texas. And they said, "We might be there 2 weeks. We might be there 3 months, 6 months. And Travis looked at us, at the congregation, and he said, "We'll be there however long it takes." That's Christianity. There's a difference between Christianity and churchianity. We got people, and I started to cringe a little bit at this phrase, but I understand it, so I'm not picking on people, and I would never come back to them and say, "Well, no, this is the way you should be thinking." But this phrase, "I just need my cup to be filled." We started hearing that at our congregation from some younger couples. They would say, "I just need my cup to be filled." And I wanted to say, you're saying that to me? I need my cup to be filled. But I know what they mean. I know what they mean, and I think there's this inherent frustration when we do churchianity because we feel this emptiness, we feel this void, we feel like we're missing something. And so we say, what they're saying is, I want to come and I want to be lifted up, and I want that energy from Sunday to carry me for the rest of the week. And I come back and I say, Jesus often collapsed, physically collapsed. You remember how many times he withdrew from his disciples to find a lonely place to pray? I was teaching on some of those passages before, and you remember his disciples, they find him, those pesky disciples, found him. Jesus intentionally found an isolated place. He went up, and he's praying, and I don't know if he's praying for the people or just praying for relief or just praying for energy. I don't know, or maybe all of those. But his disciples find him, and they say an interesting thing. Lord, there are people looking for you. You see, the disciples were so, to their credit, were so bent on finding healing for people all the time that they wanted Jesus to go and to heal more people. Come on, there are sick people. Don't you know there are people? They're dying. They're collapsing. And so I came back and I made this point. I said, when Jesus left and withdrew and went to pray, people were dying. Jesus didn't save everybody because he couldn't save everybody. And I think he modeled for us that we can sit on the ash heap for so long and become so exhausted and become so worn down and so drained that we become ineffective and we start to lose our focus on God. And so I think this model that's laid out in Scripture, it's just so beautiful and it calls us to do one thing, to be people of integrity, to do the right thing, to sit with people, to weep with people, and here's the one that's really difficult, to be silent. The thing that Job's friends didn't do, the thing that got them in trouble, was opening their mouth and trying to comfort him. And we've all experienced this at funerals, whether it was somebody who we lost or somebody we just observed this, but some of the sayings that people feel like they need to tell you. And I thank God that with my brother we did a closed casket because we didn't want to stare at a corpse for that long. And that just it was a family decision. But I respect people who do want to have open casket. But we had closed casket. But one of the things that I've witnessed when there's an open casket is he just looks so peaceful. And in my mind, I think, he's dead. He's not with us. He's not here anymore. There is no peace in that. But I know what they mean, and I'm not picking on them, and I think they're trying to comfort people, but sometimes the best thing we can do is just climb up on top of that ash heap and just sit there in silence. And we need to be people of integrity. Remember Job's wife, she said, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity?" As Job is scraping these painful boils off of his body, and his wife, who also lost 7 sons and 3 daughters, she marches up that ash heap, and she says, "Give up your integrity, you curse God, and you die." Job chapter 27, I'm going to close with this passage. Job's friends have been battering him for quite a while now. telling him, you know, God is great. You must have done something. What did you do wrong? Job, come on. What's the secret sin? What did you do? What did you do? What did you do? They're badgering him at this point. They're antagonizing, and they're trying to milk this answer out of him and find out what the dark sin is that caused all this pain and suffering in his life. Job 27, and Job again took up his discourse and said, as God lives, it was taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak falsehood, and my tongue will not utter deceit. Far be it from me to say that you are right, speaking to his friends. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. Isn't that interesting? The one thing that Job clung to through this entire episode was what? His integrity. He literally lost everything else. Job is going to maintain his integrity. He's going to do what's right and just and fair. And I think we need to remember that as Christians, and we need to remember that Christianity is not about us. Christianity is about climbing on the ash heap, finding people's sorrows, finding their hurts, finding their pain, finding their difficulties, finding their struggles, and climbing into that world with them and sitting there and doing what's right and defending the vulnerable and the innocent. Then, you know, people have often come back and they said, well, how are you able to do this? This was your own dad. I said, I don't care who it was. You see, I didn't get caught in that trap. I didn't say, well, gee, this is my dad, and how do I justify this and make this right? Or how do I explain this away? That never crossed my mind. My mind was, I don't care who this person is. I don't care how well I think I know this person. The facts are in front of me, and this person did something really, really wicked, really, really wrong, and I don't care what it takes, I'm going to stop it from ever happening again. And I wish I could stand here and tell you, it was so easy to you know, I just marched right in the, you know, when I was in the police station, my mom and I were speaking in hypotheticals, because we couldn't bring ourselves to say that it was him. We were so afraid. I was thinking, how can I felt like I was stabbing a knife in my dad's back. Later on, I found out how many victims he had and how many times he had sexually assaulted them. But I felt like I was putting a knife in his back, and I was speaking in a hypothetical. Finally, the detective looked at us and she said, you don't come into the police station to give me some dumb hypothetical. She goes, who are you talking about? And then we finally told her. I'm going to close with this. When we're on our own ash heaps, I promise you, you're not going to find this instant relief, this instant aha moment. It comes in bits and pieces. And sometimes it takes years. 3 weeks ago, my sister and her husband, who are missionaries in Haiti, they came and they were on furlough and they spoke at our congregation. One of my dad's younger victims came that day to listen to them. After service, she said, I need to come and talk to you. I said, okay. I went and talked to her, and she said, I want to do whatever it takes to stand beside you in your ministry over at Church Protect. And I want to help you to stop people like your dad from doing things to little kids, to stop them from what happened to me. I thought, isn't it? There's redemption in the ash heap, and sometimes it comes years later. And I got to be honest, a lot of times I'm doing this ministry and I just get tired and I'm thinking, does anybody even care? It's a tough, tough ministry. But to know that one of his victims came back and she noticed and she sees it and she says, how do I join you? How do I join you in this spiritual battle and how do we march forward? That is awesome. I'm going to close in prayer, then we'll take our break and move into worship. God, I come before you and just thank you for your scriptures. I thank you for this group of brothers and sisters who's they've just been so kind to me. Yesterday was just an amazing day. I'm so thankful for everybody here and for Peter and Julie and for the elders and deacons and everybody who's just been so gracious. And they're just so kind and so receptive. And God, I thank you most of all for your scriptures, for your Holy Spirit, and for your Son. God, for giving us an example, for giving us wisdom, for giving us direction, and for giving us hope. There's so much brokenness in the world, and God, we cry out to you, and we ask for your help. We ask that you reach down and you give us strength and endurance and give us rest. Allow us to take those moments to retreat and to do it unapologetically, to go and to rest and to pray, to care for our families, to care for ourselves, and then to go right back at it and to care for others. God, give us the patience, give us the endurance. Father, most of all, give us the integrity. We love you. We ask this prayer in Jesus' name. Amen.